I next met with Dr. Roy Herbst, and I particularly wanted to get his take on the historic battle trial that he and Ed Kim ran. And one of the key issues in that study was the identification of biologic predictors of response to EGFR TKIs. And to begin, I asked Dr. Herbst to comment on the mechanisms of resistance to these agents and the potential to overcome this by new agents like BIBW2992, a so-called irreversible TKI.
The greatest thing about the EGFR inhibitors in patients with EGFR mutations is you see responses with minimal toxicity in lung cancer like one never saw before. It's just incredible. But the reality of it is the median duration of that response is probably less than a year, because resistance either is present from the get-go or develops rather quickly. And this resistance tends to fall into some predefined categories, one of which is a second mutation known as T790M. It's another mutation also in the EGFR gene. And of course, the reason why patients with EGFR mutations in exons 19 and 21, the classical mutations, are so sensitive to these agents is because the drugs, erlotinib and gefitinib, can block ATP very precisely and with high affinity in those mutated patients. However, when they develop the second mutation, T790M, that abrogates that effect. And of course, the question would be, are there other agents, just as has been the case with CML, for example, that also are tyrosine kinase inhibitors for this receptor that can work in that setting? And the irreversible inhibitors, such as BIBW2992, is an example of that. There's a large trial, which as we talk now is still not yet reported, which has tested in patients with EGFR resistance, BIBW2992 versus placebo. That'll be a very important study because those would all be patients who have been on an EGFR inhibitor, failed, and now are getting the drug versus placebo to see if it actually works in that resistant setting. If that's a positive trial, that would be a very important new agent that we would then bring into the armamentarium. You would then actually postulate, you might even use it up front. You might as well use it first. But those data are still, as we talk, not known. There are other agents. There is a drug that's also being developed to work in the same way. But this is a small population of patients because you're talking about 10% of the entire population and then a smaller percentage of those who might have these specific mutations that result in resistance. That said, these are the patients you can really cure. So it is worth exploring new agents like this. This is a major area of research. The other area are those patients with c-MET amplification, which could be another 20 to 30% of the patients. Not a mutation, but just increased copies of the c-MET gene. And that overexpression, c-MET actually being the receptor for HGF, hepatocyte growth factor, being an axis that can result in resistance to EGFR inhibitor treatment. And there are a host, as you know, of c-MET inhibitors out there being studied as well. So this is a very fertile area. And an important one, because when you do get lucky enough to find a patient that has an EGFR gene mutation, you treat them without chemotherapy, they do great. When they do start to become resistant, you still do a little bit better than you would with a patient who is de novo presenting with advanced disease, but you need other alternatives. And that's where these agents will come in.
Now, you stated the word cure as it relates to patients with EGFR mutations. Is that a fact?
Well, I would probably have to step back from that and say control. You can probably take the disease and control it, and patients can live with their lung cancer as a chronic disease. I just saw a patient yesterday who is still on gefitinib. You know, you can still get gefitinib if you're benefiting from it, and you write out to an external pharmacy that she gets the drug mail ordered, and she's been on it for 7 years. I had another patient who was on gefitinib for 8 years. So there are some patients who can go for extended periods. But I think that they're never truly cured. Probably, you know, the disease is stable and it's static. And perhaps someday we'll learn about combinations where we can hit the tumor hard before resistance is developed. Maybe cocktails of an EGFR inhibitor plus an AKT inhibitor or an EGFR inhibitor plus a MEK inhibitor. But these are things that are all still in the area of protocols.
Now, getting back to BIBW, have objective responses been observed in, you know, phase 1-2 setting to people who've had progression on erlotinib or gefitinib?
Yeah, there have been some responses seen in that setting. And of course, there are responses in patients who are EGFR mutated without T790M. The question, and I don't know these details, not having been an investigator in the trial, will be in their trial, what is that population of patients in that study? Are those all patients who are EGFR mutated who become resistant? If that's the case, do they all have T790M? Perhaps they're patients who don't have EGFR mutations at all, but their best response was stability to erlotinib. These are questions that I'm not aware of the details of, and I think they will be important because the one thing we do know about every single trial with these small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors is the population that you have can make a big difference. How many patients are there with RAS gene mutations? How many patients are there with exon 19 versus 21 mutations? So there are a lot of factors that could have a role in the results of that study.
Another recent data set I wanted your take on was a study led by Mark Sosinski looking at nab-paclitaxel. Can you comment on what they looked at and what you thought about it?
That was very interesting. You know, nab-paclitaxel, which is really albumin-bound paclitaxel or a nanoparticle. So basically another way of delivering paclitaxel. And this is an approach that's actually approved for use in breast cancer, and it's used in refractory breast cancer. And I guess the idea here would be we have a drug, paclitaxel, which is quite effective in lung cancer. It's a mainstay and treatment that now is being delivered in a way where it could potentially be more effective and less toxic, because one of the main issues is neurotoxicity. The other issue with paclitaxel is that it's relatively insoluble, so it has to be mixed with a cremophore. So here you don't have to use that cremophore to administer it IV. And the nice thing there is the cremophore is what produces the anaphylaxis, which you don't see often. But when you have one of those episodes in a patient, it can be quite life-threatening. So the idea here was to look at this nab-paclitaxel with carboplatin in patients with advanced lung cancer versus standard carboplatin paclitaxel. Interestingly, the schedules were somewhat different. The nab-paclitaxel was used as a weekly, whereas the standard paclitaxel was used every 3 weeks. So that's one thing to keep in mind as you compare the results. That said, if you looked at the results and the endpoint presented at ASCO was only response rate, by an independent review, the response rate was higher for the patients who got carboplatin with nab-paclitaxel versus the carboplatin paclitaxel alone. And it was significantly higher. It was a large trial. It was well over 1,000 patients. Interestingly, the majority of these patients were treated not in the United States, but in Russia and Ukraine and other places. But still, a large experience with this drug. And the other thing that was quite interesting was when they broke it down, adenocarcinoma versus squamous carcinoma, the greatest effect was seen in those patients with squamous cell carcinoma. And the reason why that's probably important is because there have been a number of advances in adenocarcinoma with pemetrexed and with bevacizumab, leaving patients with squamous cell carcinoma without many new therapies in recent years. So my take on it is, you know, clearly it looks like it's as effective as regular paclitaxel, and by response rate, it's more effective. However, you know, anyone who's done lung cancer for a long time in clinical research, such as myself, would tell you, you have to be aware of response rate. It's going to be progression-free survival and overall survival. That's what really matters. And we were told at the presentation at ASCO that those data are maturing. And I can understand that. It takes a while to gather those data, especially when it's multi-centers from around the world. That said, the toxicity data did seem to favor the weekly nab-paclitaxel in terms of neurotoxicity and some of the other parameters. But again, you're comparing a weekly versus an every 3 week. And we know that when you give paclitaxel itself on a weekly basis, you can modulate the toxicity a bit as well. But I think clearly this is a drug that's showing equivalence with paclitaxel, and it's something we need to keep our eye on. I don't think it's going to be a great advance as far as activity. But if we think that we're in an era where we're going to use combinations and we're going to add a targeted agent or a third drug onto a combination, you would want your baseline combination to be as least toxic as possible. And perhaps this could be something, especially in the squamous cell population, that could become a backbone for the future.
Let's talk a little bit about the BATTLE trial. You and I have been talking about this for years. Ed Kim, it's really been an incredible story to follow. And you all had a presentation, I guess, at AACR first and then at ASCO. Where are we right now with this study?
Well, the BATTLE trial is complete. We're preparing it for submission for publication. We learned a great deal from this study and will continue to learn as time goes by. Certainly, we've made the case, I believe, that you can biopsy patients with advanced lung cancer. Well over 350 patients who came through our clinic with refractory lung cancer over 3 years had core biopsies.
Can you review what the eligibility of the study was and what exactly you did?
Right. So basically, the BATTLE study was for patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer refractory to at least one prior chemotherapy. So the majority of the patients, greater than 80%, had failed platinum. In fact, the median number of prior therapies was 3. And what we basically did is we, with informed consent, subjected these patients to a core biopsy of their tumor in real time. And we're fortunate, you know, having a large number of physicians and radiologists and pathologists at MD Anderson, we were able to obtain biopsies on patients within a week of their coming to our clinic and then have a result within another week, week and a half. So we really were able to get a biopsy result and then use that biopsy result to treat the patient with one of four different regimens. The four arms of the battle trial were erlotinib, obviously targeting EGFR receptor, vandetanib, a dual EGFR-VEGF receptor inhibitor. We saw vandetanib mostly as targeting angiogenesis and vascular endothelial growth factor. Sorafenib, which we felt was targeting RAF, though sorafenib also is an inhibitor of VEGF receptor, as well as PDGF receptor and several others. And then we had a combination that had been piloted by Ethan Dimitrovsky and the group at Dartmouth of targretin, which is an RXR agonist in combination with erlotinib. The thought there that that might work in some patients who are resistant to erlotinib. And we did the trial in two parts, a pre-adaptive and an adaptive part of the trial. In the pre-adaptive part of the trial, which were the first 97 patients, we obtained that biopsy and we performed 14 different molecular studies on that biopsy. And when we used those results, actually just to learn, because patients were equally randomized to the four arms. So basically 97 patients equally randomized to the four arms with biomarker profiles so that we could develop an algorithm for how patients did with each biomarker profile on each of these different drugs. And then we did something interesting. We flipped a switch, meaning our statistician got more busy. And what he did is every time a patient came onto study, we put them onto the arm where, based on those who had come before, we felt they might do better based on their biomarker profile. Now, we had a couple of things that we did for this study. One, we used 8-week disease control as our endpoint. Why did we do that? Because we had actually had some historical data that suggested that the lack of progression in 8 weeks correlates with outcome in advanced lung cancer. We actually were able to prove that in the battle trial. One of the data points that were presented both at AACR and ASCO was that 8-week disease control does correlate with survival in advanced lung cancer. What else did we find? We were able to show that EGFR gene mutations correlated with the activity of erlotinib. Of course, that's known now. It wasn't known at the beginning of the trial. So that came out of the algorithm that we studied. VEGF receptor, R2, on tumor cells correlated with the activity of vandetanib. Again, something that wasn't known as we started this, something that could perhaps be looked at in subsequent trials of vandetanib that have small benefit but not large benefit. Perhaps that would be useful. Interestingly, we saw that RAS mutations tended to suggest that patients who received sorafenib did quite well as far as disease control in that setting, whereas they didn't do very well with the other three therapies, erlotinib, vandetanib, or targretin erlotinib. So we were able to sort of differentiate the population based on molecular markers based on this trial. Even more importantly, though, you ask, what have we learned? We're still continuing to learn because now we have a resource of almost 300 patients where we have their tissue biopsies, we have their annotated follow-up on these different agents, and now we're starting to look at molecular signatures. So we can look at 5-gene, 15-gene, 20-gene combinations and ask what activation of genes correlates with activity of these different drugs. And using this battle data set, we're beginning to better understand not only who responds, but mechanistically why they respond. And we're just beginning battle 2, and battle 2 is going to build on battle 1, where we'll have a very similar approach in refractory disease. But now we're going to move to combinations of agents, because we realize that it's going to be important to look at combinations. And two of the more interesting combinations that we'll be studying in battle 2 are erlotinib plus a drug known as MK2206. MK2206 is an oral agent. It's an AKT inhibitor. So that's a combination that we'll look at to see if it's more effective in certain subgroups of patients than erlotinib alone. We're also very interested in targeting RAS, since we know RAS occurs in about 30% of patients with advanced lung cancer. And we're going to actually use a combination of agents that's been piloted in the laboratory, a MEK inhibitor, AZD6244, oral, in combination with the MK2206, the AKT inhibitor. So we're moving on from battle 1 to battle 2. I think the tissue approach is important. The one thing we are doing now in our clinic, apropos to what we talked about earlier, is patients who have EGFR gene mutations or ALK fusion translocations, they're taken out of the pot even before they go into our current battle trial. Because we now have learned enough to treat those patients with either erlotinib or crizotinib. So those patients, not part of BATTLE. BATTLE's for those for whom we don't have a marker yet, and we need to develop it and learn as we go along.
Now, what was the technology? Was it RT-PCR?
Well, we used a number of different techniques. We used immunochemistry for expression of some of the markers. We used FISH to look at gene amplification for cyclin D1 and for EGFR. And we used direct sequencing for the RAS and the EGFR mutations. For some of the signature work, which was discovery from BATTLE-1, those were Affymetrix gene chips. But yes, now as we narrow it down to 5 or 10 genes, we're using RT-PCR, which is something that can be much easier put into a CLIA compliant lab.
Now, you mentioned that one of the drugs that was looked at was vandetanib, and you also had a paper that just got published in Lancet Oncology, the Zodiac trial. And that was a double-blind phase 3 study. Can you talk about what you looked at in that study and then what you saw in the BATTLE study with this agent?
Right. That's very interesting because in the Zodiac trial, which was a large multinational phase 3 trial, 1,400 patients, we built on our phase 2 results, data that had been published a few years earlier by John Hamack, looking at the combination of docetaxel plus vandetanib. And we saw that in randomized phase 2, docetaxel plus vandetanib appeared to have an improved progression-free survival in phase 2 versus docetaxel alone. So we took that to a large phase 3 trial. The primary endpoint of Zodiac was progression-free survival, with a secondary endpoint being overall survival, and also a secondary endpoint looking at symptom improvement. And actually, this trial, as you say, just published recently in Lancet, met its primary endpoint. There was a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival for docetaxel plus vandetanib versus docetaxel alone. The hazard ratio was 0.79. So this clearly was a positive result. Now, if you looked at overall survival, the hazard ratio was 0.91. It was not statistically significant. It was not the primary endpoint of the study. And that endpoint was, of course, obscured by large numbers of patients on both arms getting therapy subsequent to the study, which is something that we're dealing with in many studies now in advanced lung cancer. It's a good problem to have in that there are more active agents that patients can get post-study. It was also interesting in the trial that if you look at time to symptom worsening, so if you ask patients, and we did this at multiple times through the trial, how they were feeling, and from 1 to 4, they scored their symptoms related to pulmonary disease, breathing, and chest pain, and so forth. They actually had a longer time to develop worsening of their symptoms when they were getting the docetaxel vandetanib versus docetaxel alone, also with a hazard ratio of 0.79. When I first saw the results of this study, and it's now well over a year ago, I was quite pleased to see that it did meet its primary endpoint, though honestly it would have been nice if we could have seen more of an improvement in overall survival. But the fact that there is improvement in symptoms going along with the progression-free survival suggests that this could be a regimen that could have some effect. However, the feeling was that the magnitude of this effect is still quite small. And this is why data from BATTLE suggesting that VEGFR2 overexpression could correlate with activity of the drug could be very interesting, because one of the things we're doing now is to actually look at that marker in the tissue specimens from the Zodiac trial. And some of the work with vandetanib is now on hold because 3 other studies with vandetanib, one looking at it with pemetrexed, an underpowered study, did not meet its primary endpoint of progression-free survival. Another study that looked at vandetanib versus erlotinib showed the two drugs to be equivalent, but vandetanib to be no better. And then a 4th study, for which we haven't seen the full data set yet, looking at vandetanib versus placebo in patients who had failed an EGFR inhibitor, I believe that study was known as Zephyr, did not meet its primary endpoint of overall survival. So while the Zodiac trial was positive, some of the other trials did not meet their primary endpoint. But you're right, it would be very interesting to see how some of these molecular markers could take a trial that's clearly positive in an unselected population and now make it overwhelmingly positive if you pick the right subjects. But times are changing, and I think that we're just at the tip of the iceberg with deep sequencing efforts now underway at many centers. No one's yet sequenced a genome from a patient with non-small cell lung cancer, but I think that will happen. And certainly if we start to do that and we look both at the tumor and the host, we're going to begin to find correlations and hopefully new targets and ways of combining existing drugs against these targets.
Any sense in terms of what the difference might be in response, toxicity, mechanism of action with these VEGF TKIs compared to something like bevacizumab?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. As long as bevacizumab's been out there, none of these VEGF TKIs has really made it all the way home. Vandetanib has gotten closer than any other. The issue with the VEGF TKIs and with any TKI is they're not specific just for VEGFR2. They're hitting other receptors as well. And as these are normally being used in combination with chemotherapy, that produces untoward toxicity, and that can result in dehydration, electrolyte abnormalities, cardiac issues, and of course, in the squamous cell patient, increased hemoptysis. So in a sense, these agents might even be more potent than bevacizumab, but by being more potent, they're also more toxic. Now, keep in mind that the data since ECOG 4599 for bevacizumab in lung cancer, there hasn't been much more since then. And I think it's quite clear that when you add bevacizumab to chemotherapy, it does help and improves response rate, but it's hard to predict where there's going to be positive versus negative results these days. The most intriguing things I've heard about recently are some of these SNPs that are seen in actually the host DNA, but these small nucleotide polymorphisms, the work of Heinz Lenz and others out of USC, first in colon cancer, and now some data recently reported at the major meetings in lung cancer that might suggest patient groups more likely to benefit from angiogenesis inhibition. The small molecules, there are still some trials ongoing with cediranib, which is also known as AZD2171. But all those studies started with a dose of 45 milligrams of the drug each day. The dose was dialed down to 30 milligrams because of toxicity. And now I believe in most studies it's 20 milligrams, showing that the drug's clearly active. But can you give it with chemotherapy in a tolerable way? Pazopamab, I think, is a newer agent, perhaps a little bit more selective. Some interesting data looking at it in the preoperative setting. Again, great proof of concept that these agents are working. They can shrink tumors. But will there be a role for it as a single agent? Probably not in advanced disease, so it then needs to be combined. So the question is, can it be combined safely? I worked with a number of these. I worked with axitinib. We did the first phase 1 work on that. I thought that was an especially potent agent with a reasonable toxicity profile. It's now in phase 3 in combination with chemotherapy. We'll just have to wait for a little bit more of these data over the next year. Though, unfortunately, I think that combinations with chemotherapy have to be used very carefully.
I'm curious how patients responded to the idea of participating in the battle study. It often is involving, you know, them getting an additional biopsy. What was their response? Do you think that most of them sort of understood intuitively what you were trying to do?
Right. Well, you know, the battle study really was a culture change, not only for the patients, but also for our physicians too. Because one of the reasons why it finally took off and really did accrue so well is because we convinced our staff, you know, we have 15 physicians in my group that treat lung cancer, that having the biopsy could make a difference. Because they, of course, are the first ones to talk to the patients. And then, of course, we had a team of research nurses to work with us. The patients were very receptive to it because most of the people we were seeing had already failed therapy someplace else. They had already heard what the options were. You know, maybe you'll get docetaxel, maybe you'll get erlotinib, you know, we don't know which will work. And they realized that here we were at least using their results to try to treat them in a more informed way. So there was a great deal of interest in this, even though patients did need to undergo a new biopsy. But they realized that that biopsy could be used for their current therapy, and then that information could then be used perhaps later on for a phase 1 trial or some other therapy. So I think I'm seeing more and more now patients who really do want to have molecular testing. As you probably know, a number of hospitals around the country now offer CLIA-approved molecular testing at the front door, certainly for some of the tests that I mentioned to you earlier, EGFR mutation, RAS mutation, and ALK fusion. I think everyone should have that in lung cancer. And you might as well keep a little tissue, and then you could check for some of the other mutations, PI3 kinase, V600E, RAF, and other things where there are drugs which are showing promise in other settings, HER2. If you have a HER2 mutation, let's use Herceptin. So patients understand this and are anxious to enter the program, and we had no shortage of volunteers to go on the study.
It's interesting you mentioned trastuzumab. Have you actually used it in any patient? I was talking to your colleague in GI/gastric cancer, Dr. Ajani. I was amazed that he'd been using trastuzumab in gastric cancer for 4 years. It was only just reported last year. Have you ever used it in a patient with lung cancer?
I have. Well, you know, we did trials, Ralph Zinner and myself, you know, 8 years ago, where we actually had studies where we were looking, not based on the mutations, which have subsequently been described, but based on gene amplification and overexpression by immunochemistry, we're trying to select 2+ and 3+ overexpressors and treat them with Herceptin plus chemotherapy. I think we had the right idea. I think the problem is, as we've learned subsequently, those immunohistochemistry tests are not that reliable. And probably if we had found those couple of percent that had a HER2 mutation, I think we probably would have seen a good result. That actually is something I'd like to just mention. And you know, we're part of a consortium. We call it the Lung Go Grant. It's a grant that Paul Bunn is the PI on, but many of the SPOR, the Lung Centers of Excellence from around the country, are involved with. And the idea is that with NCI support, we're obtaining information on a large number of mutations in samples from patients with lung cancer. But being all clinicians ourselves, we understand that this is only useful if you do something based on that. And the reason why this is so important is now you have all the groups coming together, and then we can run a large number of trials to cover every demographic of patient. So we're going to have a trial for patients who are HER2 mutated. So they, you know, it's only a couple percent, but if you're doing it at 20 centers, we'll have enough patients to see, does Herceptin really work? We'll have a trial with a PI3 kinase inhibitor, alpha, and the others as well. Do these patients respond? We'll have a trial with a MEK inhibitor and so forth. So this is the future. So there are two approaches that I think are very important. The battle approach, where you don't have any idea what the marker might be for a drug, versus, okay, we have some known markers. They appear to be driver mutations. We know this from lung cancer or other tumors. And then try to test agents in specific populations. So really, it's a very fertile time, and it's good for patients because there are more options for them with advanced refractory disease.
Now, at one point, we were seeing a fair amount of information coming out of studies that you were involved with looking at the combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab. Where are we right now with that?
Yeah, that's certainly from a scientific point of view. We actually, this came out of our laboratory work and the work of others, that if you target both the tumor and the microenvironment, you're actually hitting the enemy from multiple sides. Clearly, this improves response rate. You know, of course, this is the idea behind a drug like vindetinib, a dual EGF-VEGF inhibitor. But probably the best way to do this, the most potent way I've ever tackled this in the clinic, is to combine the two approved agents, erlotinib orally and bevacizumab IV. Every 3-week bevacizumab at 15 milligrams per kilogram, and erlotinib orally 150 milligrams a day. And a large trial that we presented last year in Chicago and will be updating for publication shortly, known as BETA, was 650 patients who received bevacizumab erlotinib versus erlotinib. This was an exclusively second-line population. We did allow patients with squamous cell carcinoma into the trial if they had peripheral disease, meaning that squamous cell disease could not be in the chest. And there were a small number of patients on the trial in that way. The results from a standpoint of response were extraordinary. The response rate was doubled by the combination, 12 versus 6%. And the progression-free survival, the hazard ratio was in the order of 0.6. So if you compare that to the vendetinib docetaxel result of 0.79, it really did have a profound effect. And we didn't study symptoms there, but you know, having treated a good number of these patients myself, I think it's quite safe to say that if a patient's tumor is shrinking by that much, they're going to feel better. However, there was absolutely no improvement in overall survival. Now again, you know, 50 plus or 60% of patients got therapy off study afterwards. So it just speaks to the fact that it's very difficult to show overall survival these days in a clinical trial in lung cancer where you can't control what patients get after the trial. Now, this combination was then taken forward to the ATLAS study, which looked at this as a maintenance. Now, of course, the SATURN study takes patients who have gotten chemotherapy and randomizes them to erlotinib versus placebo. And based on a hazard ratio hovering around 0.79, 0.8, that just got FDA approved, and you can use erlotinib in the maintenance setting. Now, the data looked better when you look at erlotinib bevacizumab in that setting. They, however, did not reach significance in overall survival. But part of the reason for that in the ATLAS study, I think, is because the trial was stopped early, because the result was looking so good and patients crossed over. So I think bevacizumab erlotinib is an active combination, clearly has a higher response rate. I suspect we'll see some use in the frontline setting. I know that there are some trials planned to look at this frontline in patients who have EGFR gene mutations. I think the use in the adjuvant setting is reasonable. If someone's on bevacizumab frontline, you can add erlotinib just as you would add erlotinib, aka the SATURN trial. But again, without the survival data being there, that regimen's not going forward as a second-line regimen.
What about the use of this combination outside of a protocol setting?
Well, it's hard to recommend it because the trial, we can't say it improved overall survival. However, if you have someone who has quite symptomatic disease and they have a performance status where they could tolerate bevacizumab, you might consider erlotinib bevacizumab in the refractory setting. I've used it on occasion. The other time when one might consider using it is if someone's been on erlotinib and they become refractory. adding erlotinib and bevacizumab together, though we don't have much data to support that. That might be an interesting trial to look at to see if it can help overcome resistance that develops to erlotinib with time.
Yeah, I've heard people talk about that. Have you yourself observed anybody having actually an objective response to that strategy?
I've had a couple of patients where they've been on erlotinib for a long period of time. Their tumor has begun to grow slightly, and I've added bevacizumab, and I've stabilized it for a longer period of time. I've not actually seen the tumor respond. I think most of the response that you see is probably from the erlotinib in mutated patients.
You know, I hear a lot about inhibitors of PI3 kinase, although I'm not sure I even know what it is, but I see you were involved in a couple of papers at ASCO looking at that. What exactly is the strategy there, and what kinds of agents are available to looking at this?
Yeah, you know, PI3 kinase is a very interesting target. It's involved downstream of some of the receptors we've been talking about, for example, the EGFR receptor. And targeting PI3 kinase has become a very active area of investigation. PI3 kinase mutations have been defined. They can be measured. They probably occur in lung cancer in about 5% of the patients. But I think we're seeing in other tumor types, you know, they're more common, for example, in ovarian cancer and breast cancer. But if you have a PI3 kinase mutation and you get an inhibitor of PI3 kinase, response rates are quite high, you know, on the order of 40 or 50%. So there is a suggestion that this could be a driver mutation for some tumors. And that's, after all, what we're looking for, not just that there is a molecular abnormality, but it's an abnormality that's actually resulting in the continued need of this abnormality for the growth of that tumor, meaning if you block it, you might see an effect. Now, PI3 kinase is somewhat complicated because there's alpha and beta, and there are different mutations that one might see, and some of these inhibitors are specific for the type of PI3 kinase mutation you have. But you're correct. There's an agent that Skip Burris presented at ASCO that we were part of the trial with a drug called BEZ, or its call letters, which is one of the first PI3 kinase inhibitors that went to the clinic. And actually, there were some very nice stabilizations of diseases and a response, actually, in a patient with breast cancer. We actually have used it only in a few patients in our clinic, but we did have a response in a patient with lung cancer. But this was a patient who had lung cancer in the background of Cowden's disease, which is a rare abnormality where you have loss of a tumor suppressor known as P10. And actually, that patient responded very well to the BEZ drug. I think that this class of agents, there are about 5 or 6 of these agents being studied now, is of incredible interest, especially since we know that downstream of activated RAS, you see upregulation of PI3 kinase on one side of the pathway and MEK on the other side. So there's a great deal of interest now in trying to target a PI3 kinase inhibitor. You know, AKT, which I mentioned earlier, is right in that pathway as well, and mTOR further downstream. So the idea being that you could target one side of the pathway with a PI3 kinase inhibitor, and then the other side of the pathway downstream of KRAS with a MEK inhibitor, one could see activity in patients with mutated KRAS, which is about 30% of lung cancer patients. And I must say, it's really the elephant in the room. It's the group of patients that don't respond to chemotherapy. They don't respond to EGFR inhibitors. So those agents are something to keep an eye on, and there are several of them that are moving to phase 2.